Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the annual Women in Religion Lecture, sponsored by the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society, and the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences Women and Gender Studies program. The guest speaker will be Lisa Sedaris, assistant professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University. The topic of her lecture will be Ethics, Empathy, and Wonder, Rachel Carson's Environmental Legacy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 14, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Susan Califf, director of the Women and Gender Studies program at Creighton University.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Sue Califf, director of the Women and Gender Studies program here at Creighton, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to this annual Women and Religion Lecture, which is co-sponsored every year by the Women and Gender Studies program and by the Kripke Center. I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Ron Simpkins, who's the director of the Kripke Center, for his continuing interest and support of this annual lecture. This year's lecture will bring our celebration of Women's History Month to a fitting close, I think. As you probably know, the theme for Women's History Month 2009 has been Women Taking the Lead to Save the Planet. And the honoree nationally has been Rachel Carson, the biologist and writer. And so tonight, Creighton is going to honor Rachel Carson, thanks to the interests and expertise of our speaker. Before hearing our speaker, we're going to honor the memory and contributions of Rachel Carson by listening to some of her own words as expressed in the new film about her, A Sense of Wonder, which I highly recommend. It's really a very moving tribute to Rachel Carson. And after the brief clip that we're going to watch, then my colleague Dr. John O'Keefe, who's been working on environmental issues for quite some time and recommended our speaker to me, will introduce our speaker. And now Rachel Carson in her own words.
I believe that natural beauty has a necessary place in the development of any individual or any society. I believe that whenever we destroy beauty, whenever we substitute something man-made and artificial for a natural feature of this earth, we have retarded some part of man's spiritual growth. In contemplating the exceeding beauty of this earth, I have found calmness and courage. For there is symbolic as well as actual beauty in the migration of the birds, in the ebb and flow of tides, in the folded bud ready for the spring. There is something infinitely healing in the repeated refrains of nature. The assurance that dawn comes after night and spring after winter. Mankind has gone very far into an artificial world of his own creation. He has sought to insulate himself in his cities of steel and concrete, away from the realities of earth, water, the growing seed, and intoxicated with a sense of his own power, he seems to be going farther and farther into experiments toward the destruction of himself and his world. There is certainly no single remedy for this condition, and I can offer no panacea. But it seems reasonable to believe, and I do believe, that the more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and the realities of this universe about us, the less taste we shall have for its destruction.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to introduce to you our speaker tonight, Dr. Lisa Sedaris, who is the presenter at the annual Women and Religion Lecture. Dr. Sedaris is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Since receiving her PhD with distinction in the year 2000, Dr. Sedaris has published numerous articles and book chapters dealing with the intersection of religion, science, and environmental ethics. In 2003, Dr. Sedaris published her first book, Environmental Ethics, Ecological Theology, and Natural Selection. In my opinion, this is a must-read for anyone interested in the current conversation about religion, theology, and the environment. As one observer wrote, "Here is the most searching critique yet of ecological theologies, particularly of their compatibility with Darwinian evolution and natural theory, natural history." Sedaris' incisive analysis opens up new possibilities for a more profound theology of nature and a more powerful and appropriately loving environmental ethic. In 2008, with co-editor Kathleen Moore, Dr. Sedaris published Rachel Carson, Legacy and Challenge. The subject matter of this collection forms the basis of tonight's lecture. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lisa Sedaris as she speaks to us on ethics, empathy, and wonder, Rachel Carson's environmental legacy.
Well, they say that Rachel Carson was very petite, but I don't think she was as petite as I am. So I hope that you can see me and hear me. First of all, thank you for coming, and thank you to Sue and everyone who made this talk possible this evening. One of the really nice things about talking about Rachel Carson and writing about Carson is that her life and work intersect with so many different things and so many different interests and academic departments. And in the past few months, I've had the pleasure of speaking about Carson to people who are particularly interested in women's issues or in women in religion. In my hometown of Bloomington, I was the keynote speaker for the Women's History Lunch, which is where they give out their Women of the Year awards and things like that. So I got to hobnob with the mayor, and it's a very different kind of setting than the kind that I usually get to speak in. And that's one of the things, too, that I enjoy speaking about Carson, is that it goes beyond just academic interest to, I think, interests that all of us have. So Rachel Carson died of breast cancer in 1964, just 2 years after her best-known and most controversial book, Silent Spring, was published. Indeed, it was on this very day, April 14th, 45 years ago today, that the world lost Rachel Carson. Silent Spring was Carson's last major publication, but a lesser-known book, The Sense of Wonder, appeared posthumously in 1965. And in some respects, the differences between these two books could not be more pronounced. To many readers of Silent Spring, and there were and are very, very many readers, the book seemed to predict an almost apocalyptic climax of human efforts to control the natural world through chemicals and technology. The Sense of Wonder, on the other hand, is a book about beginnings, about teaching children to love the natural world and to retain a sense of hope and a sense of enchantment for life, to cultivate an intimate relationship and lifelong relationship with nature. These two legacies of Carson's environmentalism, fear and wonder, are very much with us today. In my own thinking about Rachel Carson and about the environmental movement, especially in America, I've come to believe that both fear and wonder are necessary to motivate us to action on behalf of the natural world. Much of our fear now centers on a problem that Carson's generation could scarcely have imagined, but one that's become a household phrase among the current generation, namely global warming. To Carson's modern-day critics, and I'll talk more about this later in my paper tonight, there are a lot of critics currently. Just look on the internet and, you know, Google Rachel Carson and DDT, and you'll be surprised what comes up. To many of these critics, global warming is just another eco-apocalypse dreamed up in the feverish minds of liberal environmentalists who like nothing better than to cry wolf. But this is getting ahead of my story. Rachel Carson was born in Western Pennsylvania in 1907, the last and favorite child of her mother, Maria, who was herself a minister's daughter with a fervent love of the natural world. Carson's reverence for nature was built upon a religious sensibility combined with a scientific appreciation of nature's intricate functioning. She had the conviction that human arrogance and hubris lay at the root of environmental destruction. And you heard that already in some of the quotes that you heard tonight. And you'll hear a few more quotes that will repeat some of what you heard in that key passage that Sue played. Carson studied English and biology in college. She eventually made up her mind to pursue a career in science, or at least she thought she had. Years later, Carson said of this decision, quote, "I had given up writing forever, I thought. It never occurred to me that I was merely getting something to write about." She said later, too, that what surprised her most was that it didn't seem to occur to any of her teachers either, that she could possibly combine an interest in something like science and literature. So I think we have at least come a long way in allowing people to be interdisciplinary in those kinds of studies. Carson found a way to merge her interest professionally, or rather, when she didn't find it, she willed such a profession into existence. She worked as a science writer and a scientist at a time when women in such positions were rare to non-existent. She achieved such success as a writer that she was able to quit her position at the Fish and Wildlife Service, where she worked for many years, and devote herself full-time to writing and also to buy her a house in her beloved coastal Maine, which was one of the perks of her success as a writer. She never married, and for much of her life, she was the chief breadwinner of an extended family that eventually included a little boy, Roger, whom she legally adopted following the death of his mother, Carson's niece. Carson's forays into teaching Roger about nature and the memory of her own mother's nature lessons formed the basis of her reflections and a sense of wonder. Carson was outwardly conventional and inwardly subversive. In fact, what makes her such an important and interesting, and to me at least, such an eminently likable human being, is her ability to bring together perspectives that are often seen to stand in tension, if not contradiction, to one another. Science and spirituality, science and literature, reason and emotion, scholarship and activism, fear and wonder. Her influence is still felt very strongly in a variety of academic disciplines, ranging from entomology to ecofeminism, and on a variety of people, educators and parents, citizens battling toxic waste, women battling breast cancer. As many of you may know, and some of you may even recall, some of the early attacks on Silent Spring and on Carson's scientific credentials were of a decidedly gendered nature. Carson's early critics portrayed her as an hysterical, emotionally overwrought woman, a spinsterish cat lady and bird lover, unable to comprehend the science she had merely cribbed from male authorities and then wildly misrepresented. Critical reviews of Silent Spring, when it first came out, invoked a series of father figures against Carson's arguments and mocked the book's, quote, high-pitched sequences of anxiety. Time magazine called the book an emotional outburst. Newsweek ascribed to her writing a certain feminine quality of gossip and speculated about her pantheism. Magazine profiles of Carson often reinforced these stereotypes, picturing her in the woods, surrounded by children, or with her cat. By implication, Carson existed in the world of the schoolmarm, not the world of science. At the time that Carson was enduring these slings and arrows, she was struggling to be taken seriously in another realm of mostly male expertise. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer while writing Silent Spring. The discovery of her cancer and the knowledge that it had almost certainly metastasized was kept from Carson for several crucial months, even though she requested the straight facts about her condition from her doctors, asking for no sugarcoating. This is a phrase that frequently appears in Silent Spring as well, when Carson criticizes scientists and government authorities for sugarcoating the facts, for feeding us tranquilizing little pills of half-truth, as she calls it. So this image of a kind of tranquilized and mesmerized public is one that she often invoked. And in dealing with her doctors, she encountered many of the same problems where they really just wouldn't tell her the truth, no matter, you know, if she asked. Because in those days, basically, you told the husband about the wife's diagnosis, and there was no husband, so they just didn't tell her. Carson eventually found a surgeon who shared her belief in the right to know, as well as her ecological sensibilities. To this man, George Kreil, whose wife would succumb to breast cancer a year before Carson, she wrote, "You smiled when I suggested that medicine could ever be scientific, but one of the things I mean by scientific, and one of the things I appreciate in you, is your awareness of what is not known, and your unwillingness to rush in with procedures that may disrupt that unknown but all-important ecology of the body cells." There are a lot of similarities in the way that Carson viewed her cancer and the treatments that she sought to try to beat this cancer, and the way that she thought about pesticides in the environment. So rather than attacking the cancer cells with, you know, with chemicals that would then damage other healthy cells, you know, she thought perhaps there were sort of ways of doing a kind of integrated pest control sort of analogy with the body. So she tried a few experimental things that she thought really worked with the whole body instead of just sort of targeting certain cells with chemicals. So there's a lot of parallels between the way that she talked about her body as she was dealing with this and the way that she wrote about nature. Carson always had a profound appreciation of things unknown and of people who knew when they didn't know something. Long before Silent Spring, Carson was concerned about the way in which scientific and technological achievements could foster the illusion that we are in control of the natural world. In the Cold War era, Carson spied the space race with some suspicion. Upon the launching of Sputnik, she wrote to a friend, quote, "As man approaches the new heaven and the new earth, or the space age universe, if you will, he must do so with humility rather than arrogance." Of course, she goes on to say, "In pre-Sputnik days, it was easy to dismiss so much as science fiction fantasy. Now the most far-fetched schemes seem entirely possible of achievement, and man seems actually likely to take into his hands, ill-prepared as he is psychologically, many of the functions of God." Though Carson puts God in quotes in that statement, I think her message is pretty clear. Carson considered humility a major virtue and arrogance a dangerous vice, particularly in the realm of science and technology. Where did this sensibility come from? Carson was steeped in Scottish Presbyterianism, and she retained, I think, a distinctively Calvinist distaste for humans overstepping boundaries, attempting to become godlike, as well as a Calvinist sense of civic duty, a kind of calling or vocation in the world. Carson believed that a properly oriented study of nature promotes, rather than dispels, mystery, reverence, humility, and wonder. She once wrote to a reader who had contacted her to express his displeasure that she seemed to omit God from her account of nature. Quote, "As far as I'm concerned, there is absolutely no conflict between belief in evolution and belief in God as the creator. And it is a method so marvelously conceived that to study it in detail is to increase and certainly never diminish one's reverence and awe, both for the creator and the process." Carson was not one to sidestep controversy, so it seems unlikely that she merely told this reader what he wanted to hear. Rather, throughout her life, she maintained that science never edges out or explains away the mysteries in nature. And there's a quote that you saw where she talks about reality and mystery. For Carson, reality and mystery really were the same thing. What we learn about the natural world is that its fundamental reality is a mystery. You know, when we see the world as it really is, there's a phrase that comes up over and over again in her writing, the real world around us. The real world is the one that we see through the eyes of wonder. And that there's a kind of category of what's most real, always retaining this element of wonder. And that's something I think, in a sense, was her real conviction that she maintained throughout her life. In Carson's criticisms of human arrogance and hubris, we hear echoes of Calvin's interpretation of natural knowledge and the role that it plays in sustaining piety and gratitude. Calvin considered science one of God's excellent gifts that ought to evoke our awe and gratitude. I find in Calvin a subtle and qualified form of natural theology. His qualifications stem from the indisputable fact of human sinfulness. The signs of God in nature are ubiquitous, compelling, and undeniable. But because we have fallen, Calvin believed, we can scarcely see them. And thus our turn to nature is often motivated by a reckless curiosity, a desire to find clues to our own existence and our own importance. Calvin believed that we read nature selectively and discover there only our own narrow views superimposed on God's creation. In modern terms, we might say that that's a very anthropocentric view of looking at the natural world. These themes are discernible in Carson's account of nature and human nature. Silent Spring presented, and again, you saw this in the clip that you just watched, an image of humans intoxicated with their own power. Modern chemicals, Carson writes in Silent Spring, give a giddy sense of power over nature to those who wield them. Agricultural engineers speak blithely of chemical plowing in a world that is urged to beat its plowshares into spray guns. Carson's critique of scientists drunk with power derives in part from the humanitarian and theologian Albert Schweitzer, whose ideas about reverence for life had enormous influence on Carson. Carson dedicated Silent Spring to Schweitzer, and she quotes him in a few places throughout the book. One of those quotes is something to the effect that humans can no longer recognize the devils of our own creation. So Carson kind of linked things like DDT to, you know, a kind of demonic creation, something that we'd created that had gotten out of our control. So that the sort of Frankenstein, you know, way of thinking about science and some of her writing, that sort of the scientist who goes too far. But knowledge, so long as it's tethered to piety, never dispels wonder and awe, Carson believed. But human nature being what it is, the study of the natural world and science generally can also foster idolatrous and arrogant tendencies that warrant our constant vigilance. As our pride swells, the world around us contracts. Or to invoke another image from Carson's writing, we tend to look through the world from the wrong end of the telescope. We're at the short end, we're at the small end, and somehow we always get that backwards. When we reverse the telescope, we see with corrected vision. Wonder, Carson believed, provides that correction. So ethics towards nature proceeds from a basic orientation of wonder. Carson's appreciation for wonder and its ethical dimensions was also developed by her childhood exposure to the teachings of the nature study movement of the early 20th century. As part of their early schooling, the Carson children received nature study readers compiled by advocates such as Anna Botsford Comstock and Liberty Hyde Bailey of Cornell University, who wrote a lot of these books that young children at the time that Carson was in grade school received these readers, and then they were given these projects to go outside. It was always to go outside, not to spend time in class reading a book, but to really engage their senses and to, you know, look closely at whatever patch of grass was available to you, you know, and to really feel and taste and, you know, experience it through the senses. And this is something that she went on to write about in A Sense of Wonder. So to reinforce these lessons, they had their mother, Maria, the perfect nature study teacher, as well as 64 acres of their Pennsylvania farm. The nature study movement grew out of concern for the moral and spiritual development of children in urban environments who were increasingly cut off from nature and agrarian lifestyles. The movement emphasized the involvement of all the child's senses in learning about nature, a criticism of dry, fact-based education, and it sought to cultivate bonds of sympathy with all living things. In his classic book, The Nature Study Idea, written in 1911, Bailey wrote, quote, "All the senses should be so trained and adjusted that all the world becomes alive to us. Once the senses were awakened, the child's natural curiosity would lead him to want to know more about nature, a more detailed study of the natural world. But facts introduced too soon and with too much force might damage the child's sense of wonder, his ability to appreciate nature's mystery." The child is by nature a generalist, Bailey urged, and should not be forced to be a specialist. Carson would later emphasize these very features of nature education in the sense of wonder. As for the specialist is the bête noire of Silent Spring. Carson understood the pesticide problem to be largely a failure of communication between scientists working in compartmentalized disciplines. This is an era of specialists, she laments, each of whom sees his own problem and is unaware of or intolerant of the larger frame into which it fits. That was much her complaint about her doctors as well, who didn't look at the bigger picture. Today's environmental education and ecological literacy programs are motivated by many of the same concerns that animated nature study advocates a century ago. Concerns not only about threats to the natural world, but also threats to the psychological and emotional development and well-being of young people exposed to unprecedented urbanization and rampant technology. In his wonderful book, The Last Child in the Woods, Richard Louv describes the hallmarks of what he terms nature deficit disorder among young people today. Quote, diminished use of the senses, attention difficulties, and higher rates of physical and emotional illness. The modern trappings of youth, computer games, internet communities, DVDs, cell phones, texting, I don't need to tell you, you know these things better than I do, make the indoors a place that competes as never before with the traditional enchantments of the outdoors. As one little boy from Louv's study explains, I like to play indoors better because that's where all the electrical outlets are. Nature is further marginalized by education that acquaints young people with the facts of the environmental crisis, a depressing litany of environmental woes, without having first bonded them to the natural world that they are supposed to want to protect. Most children today can recite a list of global threats, but fewer and fewer have sustained physical contact with the natural world. So today, more and more writers and teachers are agreeing with Carson that instilling a sense of wonder at nature is the first step towards cultivating environmental responsibility and empathy for other life forms. I'm sure that some of you have heard of Richard Louv's book. It's already come up today in some conversations. He has a website called the Children's Nature Network, the other CNN, and they have a number of programs on there about taking children outside, whether it's a child of your own or a neighbor's child. So just to kind of, you know, take children outside and spend some time with them. And one of my favorite programs that they have is No Child Left Inside. Is one of their it's one of their agendas. So wonder is fundamentally a decentralizing orientation. That is, it tends to enhance a sense of our own relative insignificance in salutary rather than dispiriting ways. Wonder creates openness to the world around us, an increased receptivity to beauty and complexity, and feelings of gratitude for these aspects of our world. The recognition of one's place in something much vaster than ourselves, the expanded horizon so often alluded to in accounts of wonder, helps to instill a sense of humility and modesty, perhaps a sense of caution about our interventions into natural forces. But wonder is not only a response to what is beautiful, it is often far from comforting. Like the category of the sublime, it is nearly always contains dimensions of something frightening or novel or alien or radically other. Openness to otherness creates a space for empathy. As R.W. Hepburn writes in his classic essay on the subject of wonder, wonder does not see its objects possessively. They remain other and unmastered. Wonder in this sense is essentially other acknowledging. It moves us away from self-absorption and utilitarian forms of valuing. It allows forms of value proper to other beings and an openness to new forms of value. For this reason, wonder can promote, I think, not just sympathy, which is often rooted in a sense of something similar or shared, but empathy, a way of entering into the experience and feelings of others who are unlike us. So one of my recent interests has been to look at the sense of wonder as a kind of virtue in the sense that it can be sort of properly oriented or not properly oriented, depending on the object of wonder. So often, for example, when you hear science writers, Richard Dawkins comes to mind in particular, but talking about the wonders of science, it seems to me they're talking about something very different from wonder as a response to nature. I mean, ultimately, the wonder of science is really about our ability to figure it out, you know, so it kind of reflects back on the brilliant scientist who dissects the thing and thus sort of strips away its wonder. Mysteries have to be explained. Carson didn't believe that. She believed sort of the more you look at something, the more questions that lead you on and on, there will always be more mystery there. And that the mystery and the wonder really reflected back into the world around us. It's not about how wonderful we are, which I think is a very crucial difference in thinking about wonder as a virtue and how to develop it and cultivate it. Carson's ability to engage her readers' empathy and imagination, to project them into unknown worlds, was most evident in her writings about the sea. Although many people don't realize it, Carson had published 3 books about the sea and sea life prior to the publication of Silent Spring, which really was a departure from the sort of writing that had defined her career. In an author's questionnaire for her first book, Under the Sea Wind, Carson noted, quote, "Most popular books about the ocean are written from the viewpoint of a human observer. I was determined to avoid this human bias as much as possible." She describes her desire to have her readers feel that they were actually living the lives of marine animals. And to bring this about, she had to think herself into the role of those animals. "I was," she writes, "successively a sandpiper, a crab, a mackerel, an eel, and half a dozen other animals." Carson's real passion was for the sea. Growing up in landlocked Pennsylvania, she imagined oceans she'd never seen and would not see until she was in her 20s. She did some work at Woods Hole Marine Laboratory when she was in graduate school. Environmental issues such as climate change and fisheries collapse have recently focused attention on ocean life and the need for a marine environmental ethic. Some ethicists suggest that the foundations of land ethics and those of ocean ethics cannot be the same. Even proponents of what has been called the biophilia hypothesis, which comes from E.O. Wilson and some of his colleagues, acknowledge that humans' innate affinity for life is strained when it comes to identifying with marine organisms and marine realms, given humans' widespread biophobic responses to open water and marine creatures. We are not fully integrated into marine communities. At best, we are temporary visitors, guests who tend to linger on the shoreline. Oceans are alien environments to us, often represented in myth and in popular culture as akin to extraterrestrial worlds. Just think of some popular movies about oceans, ocean life, alien life. There are a lot of connections there. Planet and plankton, for example, have the same root, the wanderers. These connections are not merely symbolic. Research in astro or exobiology often builds upon knowledge of marine environments and is often conducted in marine biology labs that simulate the extreme or otherwise unearthly conditions of other planets. Marine ecosystems generally display less cohesion and more competition than their terrestrial counterparts. It's hard to even characterize them as communities. One ethicist writes that with the exception of the cetaceans, that is, whales and dolphins and animals like that, we find no heartwarming interactions among marine creatures. No play, no mutual aid, no expressions of affection, no sympathy. This may be an exaggeration, but the point is that ethics towards sea life requires not just sympathy, but a response more fundamental and more difficult, empathy. Carson excelled at evoking empathy from her readers. And she does this in a lot of different ways in the 3 sea books that she wrote. In some cases, she'll sort of give them personal names and describe their daily lives. In some cases, it's kind of the sea itself that's the main character. There's a kind of, she refuses to focus on the suffering of any one creature, just to kind of show you how their suffering is all sort of mixed up together. So you don't become too attached or sort of maudlin about the fate of any one creature. And there's a lot of bloodshed, underwater bloodshed in those books. So it's definitely a very Darwinian account. Carson's, perhaps the years that Carson spent imagining the sea strengthened her gift for portraying life in the sea to her readers, allowing her readers to think like a mackerel. Carson extends her vision via the imagination past the science of her era, whereas today's writers on the sea are blessed with submersibles and scuba gear and thus can give a more detailed account. Carson understood the human ability to see without actually sliding through the sediments of the continental shelf. Explicit references to marine conservation are rare in Carson's sea writings. She held instead to the indirect method of inculcating ethics favored by the nature study movement. And for much of her career, as many people thought in the Cold War era, she really thought of oceans as being kind of indestructible. You know, the unfathomable ocean that can absorb anything, that can purify anything. And it was really only as she began to approach the topic of Silent Spring that she began to realize that maybe oceans could be destroyed. And in fact, now we know that that is the case. And so she became very concerned about things like dumping nuclear waste at sea, with this idea that you could put anything into the ocean and it would just carry it off somehow. And so she later sort of added in a preface to one of her books on the sea that kind of makes an explicit conservation plea, but otherwise there's really not much in those writings. She didn't think it was necessary. You know, instead, if you saw the wonder of the oceans, if you read about it, then of course you would care about it. You wouldn't have to tell someone that they needed to. And thus it was an abrupt shift that Carson made from writing about the wonders of the sea to sounding an alarm against chemical pesticides such as DDT. Prior to Silent Spring, Carson's nature writing had more or less been guided by the nature study conviction that one need not teach direct moral injunctions regarding our treatment of the natural world, but should instead cultivate such bonds with the natural world that reckless treatment of nature was just unthinkable. When Carson set out to criticize indiscriminate use of pesticides, she knew that she was up against not only a very powerful chemical industry, but nothing short of a cultural icon in DDT. DDT had been heralded as a wonder chemical, the solution to major human miseries as well as minor annoyances. You can use it to kill houseflies or just any sort of annoying bugs that you might have in your house. You know, they used to spray kids at camp with DDT. They used to spray their sleeping bags with DDT. My mother remembers, and some of you may remember, running through the neighborhood chasing the DDT truck. It was like, you know, the milkman or the ice cream man or something. The kids would all chase him down the street and breathe in the DDT that was being sprayed out the back. So I guess it's a wonder that so many people weren't more harmed by that than they were. So when Carson set out to criticize DDT, she knew that she was going to receive an onslaught of very well-organized criticism from the chemical industry, who are pretty much the same people criticizing her today. It's still Monsanto and many of these same corporations. Used extensively in World War II, DDT protected troops and civilians from typhus, malaria, and other insect-borne diseases. After the war, DDT continued to be widely used in public health programs in the United States. It was credited with saving millions of lives, and the man who discovered its insect-killing properties received the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1948. It may seem odd now to think of DDT as having life-saving medicinal properties, and for this we are indebted to Carson, or have Carson to blame, depending on your perspective. Carson exposed its sinister side. She saw such chemicals as symbolic of human arrogance when applied recklessly and without any curiosity as to the impacts on wildlife. And the impacts on wildlife were enormous, regardless of what her critics say today. DDT is especially damaging to birds, particularly predatory birds such as eagles and osprey, who feed upon other organisms poisoned with DDT. Silent Spring familiarized the public with the basic concept of the food web, or the food chain, which in the 60s, this just became something that everybody suddenly knew about. She didn't come up with that concept, but Silent Spring really made it something that people could latch onto. So there's an image of the food chain in which, you know, poisons travel upward, causing disease and death to those higher on the food chain. We all know this now, particularly humans and their nursing infants. Sandra Steingraber writes in her book, Living Downstream, when you see these sort of food chain pyramids with humans at the top, what you really ought to see at the top is the nursing infant, who's the one who gets all of the stuff that's passed on and on up through the food chain. Mothers who read of convulsing birds and thinned eggshells in Silent Spring understood that these poisons resided too in their bodies, in their breast milk, in the bodies of their children. Carson, who was so concerned about future generations, encouraged us to make all of these connections. And so it's particularly ironic, if that's the right word, that images of pregnant women, nursing mothers, and sick infants are currently used to shame Carson for questioning DDT, the banning of which critics allege has wreaked havoc in the developing world, where mosquito-borne malaria kills so many of these vulnerable humans. Websites currently abound accusing Carson of junk science and ecological genocide. One such website claims that Carson's extreme rhetoric, quote, generated a culture of fear, resulting in policies that have deprived many people of access to life-saving chemicals. It goes on to say, in particular, many nations curbed the use of DDT for malaria control because Carson created unfounded fears about the chemical. If you want to know more about this issue, because it's very hard to find any sort of unbiased information on it, and it's a very, very complex issue, how it is that, you know, malaria and DDT and Rachel Carson have been linked in this way. But just to give you a very brief synopsis, you know, when DDT was banned in this country, which was, you know, under, I guess, the Nixon administration, it was banned only for agricultural use. It was not banned for public health uses. It can still always be used in any kind of public health emergency or economic emergencies, which I guess we might be in one now. But since malaria is not a big problem in the U.S., we haven't had to do that. As far as other countries banning it, you know, the U.S. bans on DDT have little to do with other countries choosing to ban it. But really, part of what happened is that the companies who had patents on DDT, when those patents expired, they had little vested interest in continuing to, you know, vehemently defend this chemical, and they ceased to do so, and other chemicals became available. So the reasons that DDT dropped out as an anti-malarial agent really have nothing whatsoever to do with Carson. And, you know, the surge in malaria cases has more to do with the use of DDT in previous years, where you get these resistant strains of mosquitoes. So it's a very long and complicated story. If you want to find a source on this to counter all of those sort of inflammatory things being said about Carson on the internet right now, I would recommend that you go to the Fish and Wildlife Service webpage, which has a number of myths about DDT and about Rachel Carson. As well as there's a new book, biography of Carson out right now that's called The Gentle Subversive. And that author, Mark Little, I think his name, has an entire epilogue that deals with this issue. But so don't take my word for it. Carson wouldn't want you to take my word for it. So that's a couple of good sources to go to. But this has become a huge issue that really has brought back the kinds of criticisms of Carson that were going on, you know, 40, 50 years ago, just that kind of fevered pitch of criticism. And so fear, it might seem, is the key word in Carson's lasting legacy. And yet, as Carson made clear in Silent Spring, quote, it's not my contention. The chemical insecticides must never be used. We have allowed these chemicals to be used with little or no advance investigation into their effects on soil, water, wildlife, and man himself. Nor was Carson particularly concerned with efforts to control nature, which she understood were something that humans had to do from time to time. She did not believe that we had no right to interfere in natural processes, but we just had to figure out how they worked and, you know, try to do it in a better way. She says in one of her speeches, "I criticize chemical control of insects, not because it controls insects, but because it controls them badly and inefficiently." She's actually quite reasonable in her comments about using insecticides and sort of combining them with integrated pest control, biological controls, as she calls them. So in truth, for some anti-environmentalists, Carson has become an unwitting symbol, a caricature, really, of all that these critics despise. A muddle-headed kind of environmentalism that allegedly cares more about animals than humans, that speaks from emotion rather than reason, a quasi-religious fanaticism forever predicting the end of the world. I think it's telling that many of Carson's most vehement critics also deny the facts of climate change. The recently deceased Michael Crichton was one of them. All of which is to say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I won't leave you on that note of fear and cynicism, but on a note of wonder. I mentioned at the outset that The Sense of Wonder was published after Silent Spring. It remains the last word that we have from Carson on the importance of wonder and the importance of never letting our fears, whether legitimate fears of environmental catastrophe, fear of the criticism of others, fear of questioning scientific and government authorities, stand in the way of witnessing for nature and its wonders. Carson had originally written The Sense of Wonder as a magazine essay. It was entitled Help Your Child to Wonder. It was published in the mid-1950s in a women's magazine, the Women's Home Companion. She had always planned to turn it into a much longer book, but Silent Spring took over her life, and then her life was over. In this little book, Carson expressed her belief that the study of nature and emotional and sensory engagement with it must go hand in hand. But the senses and the emotions must first be aroused in children. Echoing the advocates of nature study movements who so influenced her early childhood, Carson writes, "I sincerely believe that for the child and for the parent seeking to guide him, it is not half so important to know as to feel. If facts are the seeds that later produce knowledge and wisdom, then the emotions and the impressions of the senses are the fertile soil in which the seeds must grow. The years of childhood are the time to prepare the soil. Once the emotions have been aroused, a sense of the beautiful, the excitement of the new and the unknown, a feeling of sympathy, pity, admiration, or love, then we wish for knowledge about the object of our emotional response." It's worth pointing out that Carson's advice is for parents and grandparents, as well as children. She believed that all of us could discover or recover the sense of wonder, and that without it, we were truly imperiled. And just to repeat a quote that you heard a few moments ago, which is also the one that's on the bookmarks that are being passed around for Women's History Month. "The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and the reality of the universe around us," she says, "the less taste we shall have for destruction." As a way of illustrating Carson's enduring legacy of wonder, which I hope will be the one that lasts longer than this legacy of fear, which is obviously still out there. Early this year, in a sort of reverse intergenerational move, I sent my mother a copy of The Sense of Wonder for her birthday. I don't think there's any rule that says that the child can't send the book to the parent, so that's what I did. And they say it's never too late to have a happy childhood, so we can all recapture our sense of wonder. My mother had never read the book, but she had heard of it many times for me, her daughter, born in 1965, the year that it was published. So I like to think that Carson would be pleased. God rest her soul. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series. We've heard the annual Women in Religion Lecture, sponsored by the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society, and the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences Women and Gender Studies program. The guest speaker was Lisa Sedaris, assistant professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University. The topic of her lecture was Ethics, Empathy, and Wonder, Rachel Carson's Environmental Legacy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 14, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.